my aspiration or hope for the practice that we do is that it allows us to become realists. It allows us to sit in the middle of the human condition and look at it with open eyes, to look at it clearly, perhaps to look at it kindly. But the ability to be human in all the things that it is to be human in the human condition, and not to be asleep to it, not to turn our eyes away from it, but to sit in the middle of it, willingly, fully, completely. And this human condition is an amazing place with amazing amount of suffering, an amazing amount of happiness and well-being. And to be able to navigate both of those as a realist, and hopefully also as someone who understands it so deeply, understands himself so deeply, that no matter where in the human condition they sit, they know something about being free. And I would be very sad if the practice we did was a practice of escapism, that somehow it was taking us away from really facing what this human condition is like in all its different aspects. That it prepares us, trains us, strengthens us to be able to sit in the middle of the fire, in the middle of the water, wherever we find ourselves. So the teaching, the wisdom teaching for today, are on the three characteristics. And maybe to continue the form, this will be a 3x3 teaching. And so there's three characters, they're called characteristics. And that's a later Buddhist custom to call them the three characteristics. Many, many years ago, I saw a book, Buddhist book, or something, some kind of book about Buddhism, that because they're so centrally important to the whole enterprise of practice, someone called them the three stigmatas. So, but they're important. And but in the Buddha, he called them neither characteristics nor stigmatas. He called them perceptions. There are three ways of seeing. And in that regard, I'll discuss three different ways of looking at or understanding or relating to these three characteristics. So those of you who might not know what they are usually in English translated as impermanence, suffering, and not self. And one of the advantages of facing the human condition through these three frameworks, these three perceptions, is that they are common denominators of experience. And sometimes it's more effective to approach and work with a common denominator than it is to work with, you know, the tips of the branches. You know, so we have, you know, poison oak here in the property. And if we went around and just picked off the leaves, you know, it's not going to do much. They'll keep growing. But we have to really get down and dig up the ground and pull them up by the roots, because they keep sprouting from the roots. So without pulling out the common denominator of the roots, cutting out some of the little stalks that stick up is not good enough because they share these roots, and so they'll just kind of keep popping up. Sometimes the Buddha uses that language, get down to the roots and pull up the roots. But the idea of common denominator, that if you find what things have in common, that they all share as a condition, then you understand something about everything. And then you go into all kinds of environment situations and you recognize something very important in any situation you're in. And if the three perceptions have to do with wisdom, then you come with a certain kind of wisdom or prepare to see in wise ways, no matter where you go, to see, recognize how things are impermanence. Something about that being a common denominator. To see something about how things are suffering some way. The common denominator of that, which, you know, saying it the way I did can sound like depressing, but not meant to be. And then seeing the common denominator of not-self. And to be able to kind of orient and see and perceive with these kind of perceptions can make life a lot easier. I would like to suggest it makes us more of a realists. We really see what's going on in a clearer, clearer way, in a way that is freeing in maybe any situation we're in. So we are talking about the human condition, and I don't know if this really will fit in directly to the flow of the talk, but as I was thinking just a few minutes ago about talking about this, I had a vivid memory of something that I was part of a week ago. I was with a group of people who I barely know. Most of them I don't know their names. It's an ethics committee in a hospital, and I serve as a community member. And there was a person who I going to the meeting. I thought she was going to the meeting. I thought I recognized her. So we shared the elevator going up. So we talked briefly about the weather. And so it was a little bit friendly. And then we went to the meeting and we sat at opposite sides of the room. And so the meeting was discussing important ethical issues about how to care for patients in the hospital. And it was very touching to be around these people who cared so much and were really trying to do well and hear them talk about patients and how they care for them and navigate all these issues. And at one point, this woman said, this is what happened for my sister. My sister, 20 years ago, and her husband were in a car crash in Australia. And he died right away, and she was on support systems for a week or so. But the hospital was so caring for their parents, explaining to them, you know, what the conditions were, what the situation was, that it became a really easy decision at some point to pull the life support. Well, she said that, and a chill went through me. And I looked at her and said, no, her sister? And it was one of my wife's, the husband was one of my wife's best friends. And so I knew the story. And there it was, the human condition, you know, that, you know, that even 20 years later, 21 years later, for her, it was a little bit matter of fact when she told everyone there, but for me, it was, wow, you know. And so then afterwards, I talked to her, carefully going up and seeing, can I really broach this with her? Is it really her? And sure was, and I think it sounded like it was very important for her to tell me her story, what happened, and she ended up raising the 8-month-old baby who survived the car crash. So I got news about this, and it's all stories that I knew about. So I think the reason why I wanted to tell that story here is, you know, was that it was so fresh for me. But this is the human condition. then when we're talking about suffering and addressing suffering, there's lots of it. And it's not far away. We have our own, people we know have it. When we read the newspaper, we have it. Our communities have it. And it's a profound aspect of human life. And to be a realist is to understand, is to not pretty it up or deny it, but really kind of to stop and be present and feel it. And so these three characteristics are part of how we negotiate and find our way with this world that we're in. So the first level of the three characteristics is the ordinary visible level that's available to anyone to see. And I love it when I meet people who I think are really wise and seem to have a lot of freedom in this world and a lot of love and care, and they know nothing about Buddhism. It's like, wow, it's not, you know, you don't have to be a Buddhist, you know, in the little Buddhist, you know, insular world or something. It's like, we don't have a monopoly on this becoming wise. You know, so it's just, I'm inspired when I meet people, and people get really wise by what they see, the visible aspect of what goes on in this world. And sometimes, you know, I'm not talking about any of you, I don't think, but I mean, sometimes some of these people have no contact with Buddhism are wiser than the Buddhists, because they have what they visibly encountered in their world, and what they dealt with, or what they're willing to face and be with that's visible. They've gone through it and matured and find their way with it, and really found how to be wise and free and with the conditions of life. So impermanence, the first one, is certainly visible in many ways. There's a tendency, I think, in English, when we Buddhists talk about impermanence all the time, to interpret it to mean that everything will end. It's impermanent, it's not going to be permanent. At some point it'll stop, and we have to just kind of, you know, deal with it. It's not what the Buddha had in mind. Certainly things come to an end, but he was talking much more about how things are constantly changing, and they're inconstant, and that they do become different than they are. They change. And sometimes things certainly come to an end, but impermanence means much more than that. It means change of all kinds. And change and impermanence, loss, the ending of things, this whole realm of things that are called change, is really central to our human experience. Our human experience wouldn't be possible without change. We wouldn't grow from little embryos to growing people. We wouldn't mature as human beings unless there's change and we are changing. For everything that we lose, that when they come to an end, the ends often provide a new beginning, and there's something we gain. Loss and gain sometimes are not so separate from each other, though at the time of loss it might feel that way. But sometimes the end of one thing allows the beginning of something else. Someone loses their job, and then seems like a tragedy, and then something else can happen that didn't happen otherwise. If we're lucky, something good. And so to allow things to transform, to change for the better, you know, when we become happy, it's usually because something has changed. You know, sometimes we're happy that nothing has changed. It's the same thing. It can be very comforting. It's the same thing. It happened recently because a month ago, with some people who are here, I went back the first time in maybe 8 years, 9 years, to a retreat center that's kind of on a nature preserve called Hostel that we used to teach retreats in a lot in Los Altos, called Hidden Villa. And I thought things were supposed to change. And it was amazing to me how much it had not changed. There, you know, especially with a hostel, the animals were different, and you know, there were some things that were different, but the hostel was wow. And then they used to, when we were there before, they used to have things specially for us when we came, the Buddhist meditation paraphernalia. And so I asked the new manager, you know, they used to have this stuff for us. They said, oh, let me go look. And they found it. And so it made me happy, actually. And that was kind of rare, that something that didn't change. But, you know, things change, and often to become happiness generally comes because something has changed for the better in some way. But then the flip side of that is that things change in ways that brings us sadness and loss and grief and pain and suffering and all kinds of things. And so both, all these roll through life. And so we could fight it. We could heroically try to use change for our advantage and amass lots of things, lots of wealth, lots of friends, lots of likes on Facebook, lots of, you know, all kinds of things. Just gather more and more of these things that are supposed to make us happy. Suffocate under the weight of it. That, you know, that doesn't work. So how do we use change? How do we live in the world of change and find our peace with it? Well, I think sometimes when things change dramatically, that it's sometimes the only time that many people will discover how much they were clinging, how much they were attached to something. And so then, you know, they got ripped out of their hands, and sometimes in violent ways, and ways that you never wish it to happen to anyone. But then later they'll say, that was the best thing. Some people will say, that's the best thing that ever happened to me, because I didn't realize how attached I was to a certain thing. I was attached to being an athlete. I was attached to being a musician, or attached to being something. And I just, you know, that's where I got my happiness, was all the approval I got, all the praise I got, all the sense of being, I don't know, a special person. And I was kind of living on this juice, you know, this energy of success. And I wasn't really happy in a deep way, but I didn't realize it until it was taken away. I was in an accident and I lost my ability to do X, Y, and Z. So it happens that way sometimes. And I certainly don't want to glorify having this kind of loss or recommend it. But, you know, it does happen in this world. It's how the visible, seeing impermanence and change. And then some people are able to, sooner or later, see, well, that was actually a good thing, or I was really attached or holding on, or I was always expecting it to be a certain way. And now I'm much more, I've known people who were idealists and couldn't see what was really going on. And then when reality really hit them, then they could see. And then the whole conversation with them became a whole different thing. And then it seemed like remember there was one person who was very Pollyannish. Just everything was kind of, she was literally a flower child of the 60s that, you know, never left Golden Gate Park with flowers in her hair. And everything was supposed to be kind of wonderful and sweet and love everywhere. And one day I told her, you know, the reason why people are always pulling away from you is because they always find you to be angry. And I gave a lot of thought, maybe a few years, about whether I could say this to this person in a kind way or supportive way. And I finally said it. And I didn't know what was going to happen, but I was there, but I felt I had a responsibility. And she collapsed. It was pretty awful for about 2 minutes. And then she kind of lifted herself up and said, now I understand. Now I understand what's been going on. And she was really grateful. And from that day on, I could have a realistic conversation with her. What's about herself? What was going on? And made a huge, you know, something finally, after decades, broke, and she was able to kind of drop these veils or this filter that she was seeing through. So change, to understand that there's change, all kinds, that things come and they go, that they're, and that's built into this life. And you go to a place like Thailand, a Buddhist country, there they grew up with it, kind of with the mother's milk, you know, anicca, they say, impermanence. And if you, you know, if the, you know, they're ready to say that all the time. So like if you get a flat tire, you know, the first response is not, oh, wow, this is, you know, my, oh, this is terrible. This is like the worst thing that happened today. And this is like, a, you know, why me? The first thing they'll say is, oh, look at that, anicca. Of course, change. Of course, impermanence. I don't know if we want to be that extreme on this, but to understand how deeply, you know, this is part of this human life, and to not to expect change, to always expect that things will be just the way you planned, just the way you've set them up, like you've finally got all the pieces in place. You've spent years building it all up just right. You know, and I could, whew, now I can relax. And then something happens. So so there's the ordinary experience of change and the impermanence we see in life. There's also the, I don't know if it, I don't want to belittle it by saying ordinary suffering, but it's the visible suffering we can experience, and or experience for ourselves or experience in the world around us. And we see it's, you know, so common in this world of ours that to appreciate that this is the nature of a world we live in, so that we're not protesting in ways that are counterproductive, that we're not casting blame in counterproductive ways or running away or addressing it in ways that are not really helpful. I would hope that we have a compassionate response to suffering in this world. But if we don't appreciate how deeply in the fabric of human life suffering is, you know, it's a little bit hard to really find our way with it. One of the ideas about this word dukkha, translated as suffering, is that it also means unsatisfactoriness. That the things that we think are going to make ourselves happy, it might be a temporary happiness, or it might be happiness that's not really happiness at all. I remember really wanting a toy for Christmas when I was 8, 9 years old. Really, well, my parents didn't want to give it to me. I really wanted it. I really wanted it. So they gave it to me. I played with it once. So, you know, I thought it was going to make me, you know, happy forever, I guess. And so this kind of confusion about happiness and what brings happiness is part of the becoming wise about suffering. Because the shallow pursuit of happiness, or the investing too much into some kind of worldly happiness, that it's, that's what's going to do it for me, or depending on the world for our happiness, depending on, you know, on all kinds of things, goods, possessions, money, jobs, relationships, really depending on them, that's where my happiness is, that only source of my happiness, you know, it's sooner or later, it's going to be disappointing. Maybe it shouldn't be if the universe was organized better. But it seems to happen, right? You know, all too often. And so how can we be wise about that? How do we see that and see it in a way that, you know, doesn't add to the misery, add to the problems? I talked about the Four Noble Truths the other day, and a friend of mine teaches the Four Noble Truths in the state prisons. And he was the one who taught me that for this idea that the second noble truth, when he teaches it to the inmates, it's the second noble truth is don't make it worse. And part of the value of that in the prison is that it's pretty bad. And they're being treated really badly, the prisoners are. And so it makes sense to protest. It makes sense to raise your hand and say, wait a minute, this doesn't make sense. But to do that in the prison just makes it worse. So don't make it worse. So that's a little bit of a wisdom piece. We're suffering. Don't make it worse. There's all kinds of ways we make it worse when we suffer. Blaming ourselves, blaming others, ignoring it, attacking, working harder, amassing more things, clinging more, all kinds of things, drinking alcohol, drugs, all kinds of addictive behavior, which doesn't really make it better, except it's a kind of temporary relief. It's not really addressing it and finding our peace with it. Unsatisfactory approaches to happiness. So some people get wise. Some people get wise about how they're pursuing happiness in ways that are not helpful when they bottom out. And sometimes that's the only way it happens. I've pursued happiness as, you know, maybe it's not as, I don't want to put myself in the shoes of people who go through this in very deep, dark ways. But I was pursuing happiness through concentration and meditation when I was a new meditator. And the more I concentrated, or tried to concentrate, the less concentrated I got. And so my solution was to try harder. And so that didn't work. So what do you do? Well, just try harder. And I was so miserable. I was so hard. And finally, I just bottomed out. And bottoming out meant I just went, I give up. And that's when my practice began. It wasn't a plan. I just like, oh, I give up. I can't do it anymore. But I wasn't capable of seeing what I was doing. I didn't have the wisdom, the eyes, to see that my pursuit for happiness was ill-founded. And so I had to just play it out until it just kind of came to an end. And luckily, it wasn't too much damage. Just some tears. And then there's this thing about seeing not self. And that also can be seen in ordinary ways. Sometimes it's easier to see it in other people, that the self that they're holding on to, the identity that they're trying to force in their world, is not really, it doesn't make sense. Sometimes when they're have very negative self-identity, like, you know, I'm you know, poor me, and or they are presenting themselves with a lot of conceit, you know, I'm really special. And you see, they're holding on to some notion of self. Sometimes it's easier to see it with others. Sometimes it's easy to see it when people make you a self, and they treat you as you're that kind of self. And so, you know, you kind of say, stop, I'm not that. And so we're kind of defining, people define each other. It's harder to see how we do it for ourselves, how we create a definition of ourselves, or try to identify ourselves, or try to prove who we are, or apologize for who we are, or create an impression of who we are for other people so that they know who we really are. Though it's not who we are, it's just the persona we're trying to project. And so this whole self game, when I was a new Buddhist practitioner, there was a book called Games People Play that was popular. I never read it, but I saw the title. My parents had it. But that title stuck in me. So when I started my Zen practice, I saw how I was doing all these social games, playing to games to get people, like I said the other day, to like me, to get the people to see me a certain way, trying to, you know, and it was exhausting to play it. And I could see that this self game that I was playing didn't make sense. And I knew I had to let go of it, but it was really like feeling I was on the edge of a chasm. I knew what I had to let go of, but I didn't know how, and I was too afraid to let go of it. This idea of self, self-identity, such an intimate, deep aspect of who we are. We grow up being, you know, forming a sense of self in order to find our way in the world, to be safe in the world, to protect ourselves. You know, it's a tender thing to build up and create a self, a self-understanding. I think we have to be very respectful and loving of what all this is. And I don't think anybody can grow up in any society without learning some kind of identity, self, self-concept that they hold on to. That probably sooner or later as an adult will cause some suffering for them. And so some people can see that. It's visible, you know, wow, but boy, am I holding on to, you know, being the best basketball player in high school and, you know, or being seen as a basketball player and I can't, you know, and I didn't make the varsity team, so I didn't realize, you know, how hard it was for me. So these are kind of the visible things that we can see, and if we just open our eyes and look better, we can see a lot more of the visible world of how things change, the suffering of this world and ourselves, and the whole self thing and how that plays itself out. And it's pretty painful to watch the self games going on in our society and all the different forms it takes. And then we come to the second layer of the three characteristics. And this, I call it the Vipassana level. And this is a level where we start seeing below the concepts. Now we're getting down into more the common denominator, the things that are part of everything. And at a level that is not so conceptual. It's not a story. It doesn't depend on remembering what happened yesterday and what happens today, and then comparing and say, well, it's not the same as it was yesterday. It's just seeing, really the insight, that's why it's called insight. It's actually seeing the river flow. If you see the river from far, 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 far away, it just might look like a flat sheet of something that's unmoving even. But if you're sitting at the edge of the river, you see all the little currents, you see the little wavelets, and you actually, it's really clear, you're actually seeing it move. So to be settled enough in meditation, to start seeing where there's a constant river of experience that's flowing and moving, and seeing all the little currents and rivulets and wavelets and all the different coming, sparking, and raindrops and snowflakes and sparks of experience that comes and goes, that are the building blocks for the concepts we have. So, for example, what's a good example of something that's changing? I remember I was on retreat in Burma, and I had a lot of struggle with sleepiness in the evening, in the afternoon. And I had this whole war going on with myself. It was actually quite painful, and a lot of anger and stuff. And one day, I just got interested to see if I could notice the first moment of first little symptom of being tired. And it took me a few days before I could see it, you know, like, because I've already been tired for a while before I kind of noticed it. But I think, can I watch that change? And when I watched the change and see it first appeared, I saw that it arose without any war. It just was there. The flow of experience arose and it came, and then the tiredness flowed more and more, but then it just became part of the flow of experience. And it didn't become such a big thing to have to fight. But when I was living in my ideas, I need to get concentrated, I need to practice, I need to, you know, be clear, and, you know, and this is interfering with my, you know, practice, and you know, I need to, right? And me. You know, it was just a lot of suffering. But when I just saw it as a flow of these sensations of tiredness in my eyes and my cheeks and stuff like that, I could experience it without this overlay of attachments I had to my practice, to myself, to all these things, and just kind of been with the flow of it all. Our lives are a river, and we put ourselves in the river. And if you can find the current of the right current, it'll take you to freedom. That's an amazing thing. That's where this idea of impermanence, to really see it at the cellular building block level, then it takes us to freedom, if you allow it to. And so to feel not, like this is the butt thing I said the other day, right? To not feel, you know, my hand touching my hand, but feel the warmth and the vibration of the warmth, the flow and the glow of the warmth as the hands touch, to feel the pressure and the smoothness, and to feel how those sensations that are there are changing and fluxing and moving and all the time. If I kind of keep thinking about my hands and how my hands are not really perfect hands, I wasn't really born with a good set of hands, and it's a little bit embarrassing to hold my hands up in front of these people because my hands are my, you know, that's like a recipe for disaster. But if I don't think about my hands in that conceptual way and just feel the experience of it, it's kind of exquisite. My hands are just fine on their own. It's my concepts and ideas I make about it where I start suffering. And so I can drop down, let me just feel the hands, the warmth, the tingling, the vibration. Let me just feel it. Let me live there rather than living with all these 60 years of thoughts about my hands being inadequate, something like that. It's a much better, nicer world, this world of direct contact, the building block of experience, the sensations that are there. And so it's part of the training in Vipassana is to drop down, to get calm enough, steady enough, so that the thinking mind is not swirling in stories and ideas of past and future, but to let it become quieter so that we can start seeing that whatever is happening, including the flow of thoughts, see it as just a flow, a part of the river of change, river of experience, as opposed to something we grab and take hold of and grab. And so we can see change. Change, as we start seeing impermanence change in constancy, this flow of things moving all the time, then in Vipassana, we start seeing much more clearly that things are unsatisfactory, that they're dangerous in a certain kind of way, that, you know, that really doesn't really work to grab onto them. Clinging to them now has a whole, the idea of clinging has a whole different feeling to it. Like any movement of awareness towards it, any closing down, any pulling back, any little judgment about the experience can feel, maybe the word suffering is too big of a word for this, but feels unsatisfactory, feels stressful, feels like this is a drag. And to start seeing kind of, again, a very subtle level, how much being for and against our experience is constantly going on, that's really not visible in an ordinary mind. You have to have a kind of really quiet, sharp mind to see the constant wanting and not wanting. And that was the great benefit I received from being introduced to Vipassana practice, is that I'd done Zen practice for many years and gone through a lot of growth and change and through that. But when I was introduced to Vipassana, I discovered that I was doing pretty well at a macro level, kind of. But I hadn't really learned to pay attention at the micro level of experience. And at the micro level of moment to moment, in the moment to moment perception, experience, and reactions to things, I had a lot of attachments going on, a lot of clinging, a lot of self, a lot of for and against going on. It was very subtle, but subtle doesn't mean that it's unimportant. So to start seeing these little micro movements and just learning to settle back and just settle down and letting things be and no longer looking for answers, no longer looking for something's going to do it, even in meditation. Oh, if only I have that thought, that, what's that? Oh, that's a little bit of, that's a little bit of joy, isn't it? That must be that joy thing they're talking about. Let's push that little bit. Oh yeah. Oh, where there it went. Where'd it go? Or he's been talking about impermanence. How important it is to see impermanence. I'm going to sit down and really see it at this with a little microscope, and really, I'm going to really bear it and see impermanence. It doesn't work. At some point in this micro level, you see the awareness, just let it back off and just be clear and awake. But just be with it. And so this micro level, start seeing it. We are always wanting. And then to see this idea of self and not self, to see the subtle movements of conceit, not the movements of like, I'm going to be the best meditator on Sunny Acres, but rather this little movements, how we kind of impute or we kind of hold on to, attach to even the idea of a location for ourself, that awareness has a location, a place from which I'm aware, is a kind of formation of a self. And even the idea that there's a center of experience. Even the sense that just to be is too much self, believe it or not. And so as we get, and the alternative to this selfing is a deep experience of equanimity. To really become equanimous, where there's no reference point, nothing, what's being experienced has no reference point to a self, to an identity, to me at the center, to me as, even me as an observer. Even the idea of observer, the observer falls away. So at this Vipassana level, this idea of not-self becomes more and more subtle, more and more kind of deeper. And in doing that, it becomes freer and freer. There is a tendency in classic Vipassana practice to go through these three characteristics kind of sequentially and to learn the lessons of each one as we go through. There's a tendency that in the early stages of Vipassana, it doesn't have to be this way, but the early stages, that a lot of what people are coming up against is impermanence and change. And coming to find their peace with the changing impermanent nature of phenomena. And the big lesson from that is to not overlay a lot of concepts, to free ourselves from the stories and ideals and judgments we have on experience, to begin letting the flow of experience flow itself, allow it to be its own thing, without us overlaying ideas and expectations and concepts that we have. And so when we start feeling this micro movement of the flow of experience, it becomes easier to understand the distinction, the difference between the flowing experience and the label, the stories we make. The analogy I like to use for this is if you go down to a river and you see the river flowing, and the river is just doing the river thing, and how nice. It might be very relaxing to watch the river. You're kind of, you become one with the river. It's so great, you know, and you wake up from your oneness with the river. It's been great. And you say, this river is great. I want the river. So you take a big bucket and you dip the bucket into the water, and you go back to the village and say, look, I have the river. You know, you don't have the river. So when you to really see the flow and see how concepts and ideas and judgments are a little bit like carrying the bucket and the weight of it, that's one of the lessons that this early kind of first phase of Vipassana. And then there comes a phase where dukkha or suffering becomes salient often, and things are unsatisfactory, or you see the stressful nature of it, and sometimes this can be kind of hard to experience. And the lesson here is a lesson in a certain way, I mean, everything's contextual, but in this particular format, this particular state of mind, to learn to have no desires, to be desirelessness, to learn just to let things be. And that's really hard when things are uncomfortable and they're suffering, when things are not working right, when the practice is not working, to just keep practicing with no desire. And so learning to let go of desire and learning what it's like to just practice, be sincere, be dedicated in practice, keep being mindful, but to do it without getting caught by the desires we can have. And then the lesson of this not-self thing is a lesson of equanimity, to learn to discover the clarity of mind, the openness of mind, the unrestricted nature of the mind that's possible when the mind is really equanimous and peaceful. To not impute self, not rest in self, not be rooted in self, at least in the context of this kind of Vipassana meditation. So those are the first two. The third level of the three characteristics is the ways in which they are freeing. That these three perceptions are actually liberating. They actually help us to release the grip of our hold onto on reality or self or ideas or whatever it might be. And so a little bit repeating what I said is that when we really understand that our stories and ideas and how much we cling to them and how that's holding a bucket rather than letting the river just flow, that then at some point we kind of let go of these stories we're clinging to. We just put down the concepts, the judgments. We release it. You're not going to betray them. The ones that are good, you can pick up again later. It's fine to have them. But to really have the experience of really releasing them, really putting them down in a very full way, it can be life-changing. And so to really understand stories, ideas, and okay, enough of this, enough thoughts. The suffering thing is this, it comes with liberation of not having any desires. There's different degrees of doing this, but to really finally, wow, I've been riding desires. I've been one desire after the other every second of my life. Just, it's kind of astounding when your mind gets quiet enough to see how much desires are operating all the time. Even the way that we look at something, it doesn't have to have a desire in it, but you know, I hear a sound of a car, and I there's a kind of desire for something in trying to listen to that sound better. The desire for, I don't know what, but there's a kind of a desire for something. Maybe a desire for pleasure, or a desire to get rid of something irritating, or, you know, desires are so deep. To really see how this operates and really get a sense of the unsatisfactory nature of pursuing all this, and to do it in this deep place where the mind has finally gotten peaceful, something in the mind around desire lets go. And there's a release around the world of suffering. And then the same thing with the world of self. To have enough really peace, this equanimity, this place, but there's not even any center to self. And then to feel, see the phenomenal emptiness. Empty of self. And that in that empty, and to feel safe in that place, to have so much equanimity that there's no self-consciousness in this empty of self place, that something gives away, releases, lets go. The emptiness of the mind that's not vacuous, but the mind which is not being defined by anything. The mind often is defined, limited, held in check, solidified by what we're attached to, what we cling to. And when there's no clinging whatsoever, there's no thing there to define the mind, to shape the mind, to limit the mind. And so the mind has this vast feeling of emptiness. But it's not the emptiness of nothing. It's the emptiness of our full humanity. All our intelligence, our good hearts, our ability to be wise can flow freely in this space of awareness which is empty of definition, empty of shape, empty of anything in it. It's like, maybe it's a little bit like if I think about it, I can remember what I had for dinner yesterday. But when I was meditating this morning with all of you, I had no thoughts about yesterday's dinner. I'm pretty confident about that. And if I had looked around my mind, it would have been empty of dinner thoughts. But those thoughts, that memory, existed somewhere offline, out of sight. A lot of our intelligence, a lot of our life is sitting waiting for us in the place where we can't see. So this idea that the awareness becomes vast and empty doesn't mean that you lose anything. It means you have the freedom and the space for all this wonderful stuff inside to surface of who you are. And you get your full humanity minus something. If you're okay with minuses, having a little bit less of some things, I'll tell you what you're less of. You get your full humanity minus attachment, minus clinging, minus craving, minus hate. So I think that's a pretty good. And I like to say your full humanity. So we sit in the human condition. We're not trying to avoid the human condition, but to sit in it really well, really take your seat in it. Really take your seat, be rooted here in your experience. Really be willing to open up and experience here in the deepest, fullest ways you can. And you'll discover you'll become more and more human, more full, the more free you become. My wish for each of you is that you become more yourself in your beautiful way through this practice. Each of you are phenomenally beautiful and wonderful. And I hope this practice just kind of brings that out. When that little extra stuff that's getting in the way of it, has retired. So let's sit for a few moments in the river of our experience.